Far from the war in Ukraine and multiple fronts in the Middle East, a power grab between feuding coup leaders rages on. Since April of 2023, Sudan's descended into a full-blown civil war where the momentum swung several times and may be again, what with the government forces of Abdel Fattah al-Burhan trying to recapture the whole of the capital and a senior general switching sides, defecting from the rapid support forces of Mohamed Hamdan Dogolo, a.k.a. Hemeti, who's laid siege to the last major city beyond his reach inside of his native Darfur. We'll ask about the dire situation there, the spillover effect everywhere from the Sahel to the Horn of Africa, and the discreet backers who make this nightmare possible to a degree. Rival sides found themselves at the same table at this week's BRICS summit in Russia, with the West helpless elsewhere. What can be done to stop Sudan's wanton destruction and put its revolution of 2021 back on the rails? Today in the France 24 debate, Sudan on the brink. With us, two guests who've had a firsthand look from Cairo, political analyst and commentator Dalia Abdel Monaim. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Human rights activist Ghaffar Mohamedou Sainin is with us as well. Good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Historian Gérard Prunier, the author of Darfur, a 21st century genocide. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And from Brussels, Claire Sanfilippo, emergency coordinator for the humanitarian aid group Doctors Without Borders, MSF. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24debate. Let's begin 1,000 kilometers away from the capital in Darfur, a vast multi-ethnic expanse that's endured a genocide two decades ago, where Hemeti's RSF has laid siege to the only regional capital still in government hands. You can see on this map, El Fasher. This was on the one side how it looked in back in May and how Sudan looks. And the part you see on the in the west, the Darfur parts, as of October the 8th, around North Darfur's capital, evidence of war crimes, with researchers at Yale University in the United States earlier this month publishing satellite imagery that shows the torching of at least 14 villages. 2 weeks ago, MSF issued a plea for help after suspending services at the Zamzam refugee camp, this to a blockade by fighters. Claire Sanfilippo, tell us about that blockade.
Thank you very much. Well, I think, you know, the situation in Sudan is absolutely dire generally, and that applies as well to Darfur. And there we see really multiple health crises day in and day out. And terrifying malnutrition rates. I really don't have any other words to describe what is happening, particularly in Darfur. In Zamzam camp, we screened over 30,000 children in the camp, and we found horrifying rates of acute malnutrition of 34%. Just to give you a reference, 15% is what the World Health Organization considers the emergency threshold. So at this stage, we're not talking about an emergency. We're really talking about a nightmare, twice over the emergency threshold.
And just to update us then, it was October the 10th that you had to suspend supplying the Zamzam camp. What's been the situation since?
Well, you know, it's always heartbreaking when we have to suspend activities. And in this war in Sudan, MSF has had to suspend medical activities on multiple occasions because of obstructions that we've seen were systematic from the warring parties. In Zamzam, what we have seen is indeed a supply blockade. Essentially, most supply roads to Zamzam camp are controlled by the rapid support forces. And for weeks and months, they've made it all but impossible to bring essential supplies since the intensification of fighting around Fasher in May. And as supply routes ran low end of September, we've been forced to stop care, as you said, for 5,000 children, and that included 2,900 children with severe acute malnutrition. As you know, children can die if, you know, they're not supported and they are severely malnourished. So we continued to have a hospital in the camp, 80 beds. It remains functioning, but it's basically to treat the children at the greatest risk of dying. After almost months of complete blockade, we've seen positive signs in recent days, with only a handful of trucks arriving. But what I'd like to emphasize is that the quantities are vastly, vastly insufficient. To give you an idea, the United Nations have managed to brought from Chad about 200 trucks since August 15th. 200 trucks, that means around 3 trucks per day. According to our nutrition experts, just to feed the people of Zamzam camp, that is one camp in one town in North Darfur, which is one of the 5 states of the Darfur, we would need at least 13 trucks per day.
And let me ask you about 13. This, Claire, because you were on the border in Chad just up until a few days ago. Is the fact that there's not enough aid getting in because the international community is not sending in enough, or because it's being obstructed?
Well, I think, you know, let me tell you what women and children told me. When I was in Eastern Chad, I was at Tine, which is right at the border between Chad and Sudan. And there, virtually at the border crossing transit camp, all the people are women and children. I talked to quite a few women, and what they described to me was a harrowing trip. They all came from El Fasher. It took them a month to come. During, you know, this trip, what they told me about was uncertainty, fear, and deprivation. They didn't have food. They had to rely on the generosity of people. They didn't have access to water, so they drank stagnant water. And what you can see when they arrive is you see jerry cans of water. The water is brown, and sometimes there's even algae in it. So as you can imagine, as a result of this trip, when they come, very often we see malnourished children, and we see pregnant and lactating women who are malnourished. So this is, you know, very, very serious situation.
But my question is about, you're saying not enough trucks are getting in. Are not enough trucks getting in because the international community is not sending enough aid to the region, or because those trucks are being blocked by fighters?
So there is a key issue in terms of obstruction. As I mentioned, there really was, you know, a supply blockade on Zamzam. This is something we've seen since the very beginning of the conflict, and that we're not only seeing in this area in Darfur, we're also seeing this in the areas controlled by the Sudanese armed forces, where we as Doctors Without Borders have been prevented systematically from sending supplies from Port Sudan, that is an area controlled by the Sudanese armed forces, into Khartoum in areas controlled by the rapid support forces. So this is a key obstruction that we continue to see, and we really need immediate, unhindered humanitarian access. We need to be able to do our job to improve the situation in Sudan.
Ghaffar Mohamed Sainin, you're Darfuri. You have family in El Fasher in North Darfur. What are they telling you?
Well, what they are telling me is shocking, disturbing. It is the situation has reached beyond critical stage since as early as February, when MSF published that report of every 2 hours a kid's die. And that number has tripled today. You're talking about every 3 hours, every 2 hours.
Because how long has the siege been of El Fasher been going on?
The siege of El Fasher has been going on as early as October 2023.
And it's still going on
It's still going on, but the siege has been intensified after May 2024. The siege started immediately after a joint force of armed struggle movement declared that they will depart from the neutrality position. So the siege was, you know, started from that point. And after, immediately after the siege began, those humanitarian convoys used to come from all the way from the Port Sudan were prevented.
From the Red Sea?
Yeah, from Red Sea all the way through the Sudan and reach Al-Fashir were deliberately prevented by the rapid support forces. Few humanitarian convoys that used to come through Chad and all that as well was deliberately prevented by the rapid support forces. And the siege has been intensified after May 2024. This is where the thing start, you know, became very complicated. Nothing is getting out of the town and nothing is coming inside the town.
And what about, what's the situation since the end of last month? Because General Al-Burhan, he was in New York for UN Week, and that's when he launches this offensive in the capital, Khartoum, and in other places, claiming that he's going to try to have a link between, he's going to try to break the blockade. It's been nearly a month. What's happened?
What's happened has been because when the war started at the on April 15, the army was not really...
Of last year.
Yeah, of last year. Army was not ready. So all this, the past 15, 16 months, the army was in preparation to launch, you know, I mean, last offensive, at least to take the control of the area of the greater Khartoum.
And in the last month, what's happened?
Last month, they managed to break that, you know, I mean, the deadlock in Khartoum. They managed to cross the border, the bridges to Khartoum, from the Omdurman to Khartoum. So they are now closing in the rapid support forces in the southern part of Khartoum. It's only a matter of time before we hear the full liberation of greater area of Khartoum. So that will leave. And at the same time, what's taking right now place, the other offensive fronts taking place in Al Jazeera State, in the central...
Yeah, before we talk about Al Jazeera State, let me ask Dalia Abdelmonem, because you're from Khartoum, are you originally... what are you hearing as far as this offensive crossing the Nile inside of the capital? And I mean, it's been nearly a month. What do we know?
Well, according to the reports that I read today, the Bahri, which is the north Khartoum. Khartoum is divided into like three mini cities: Omdurman, Khartoum, and Khartoum North. And the army offensive in Khartoum North, Bahri, has taken ground. But it is a slow process simply because Khartoum is very densely urbanized and the RSF embed themselves within these urban areas. So, and the SAF strategy, war strategy, is aerial bombardment. And most of the time that aerial bombardment is very, very indiscriminate. So what you get is a lot of attack happening in the country. But I'd like to go back to your point about the obstruction of aid. The obstruction of aid is being used as a weapon by both sides, both the RSF and SAF. SAF previously was not allowing any aid to enter RSF-controlled areas, and same thing was being applied by RSF. And at the same time, funding for Sudan aid is really slow. I think the budget, the fund that the UN put up was like $2.9 billion. And so far, I think only 18% has been pledged or given. So aid is trickling. It is beyond trickling. It is worse than trickling down to Sudan. The floods, the rainy season did play a part. However, both sides are a major factor in the obstruction of aid reaching to the civilians. And unfortunately, the protection of civilians is not a priority for either side, nor does it seem that the protection of civilians is a priority to the international community as a whole, because the outcry for what's happening in Sudan is very muted. For a war that's been going on for more than a year and a half, we don't get much, from the international community, where it's like we're a side topic, unfortunately. But it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world right now. We have the largest number of displaced people in the world. The number of people who are becoming refugees is increasing by the day. And in the past 72 hours, I think the number of deaths in both Fashir, Khartoum, and the Jazeera, and several, and in Kordofan, has hit more than 300 civilians, including children. That's just within 72 hours, because the RSF is on a revengeful campaign simply because of the defection of their former RSF lieutenant. So the situation is beyond dire. It is, and it's there's no that sense of urgency is not there, and that's something that agencies like MSF and Norwegian Refugee Council have been calling out for since day one of the war. But their calls have fallen on deaf ears, unfortunately.
Yeah, because there's several factors here, Dalia. There's, like you say, there's the offensive. There's this major defection. Abu Akla Kakil, a rapid support forces commander in Al Jazeera state, sources telling the Sudan Tribune news site that the surrender, that his change of camps followed intensive negotiations. That, in turn, as you say, has sparked reprisal attacks, several media reporting the killing of civilians, the torching of fields and villages in Jazeera State. This was billed as a turning of the tide, this offensive by the government. It just feels like a forever war from what you're describing, Dalia. All right, may have lost the connection there with Cairo. We'll try to get back to that in a moment. Gérard Prunier, you think back to 2021, the overthrow of longtime strongman Omar el-Bashir. We saw civil society coalesce in Sudan, and now we're watching this argument between two generals turn into a descendant.
Well, this is the way the media pictured it. We have two apprentice dictators who want to grab the power for themselves. I'm afraid it's a little bit more complicated because the Sudan never existed. It was an empire which was a projection of the Ottoman Empire. And the British, when they came in 1898, just took it as it was. This was, the British never had a colonial policy, contrary to the French. The French wanted a unified colonial view, whether it was Indochina, Madagascar, or Algeria. The British never did that. They took what was there. And in 1898, when they reconquered the Sudan, which they had lost at the time of Gordon, they decided to just take it, to buy the whole thing lock, stock, and barrel. The important thing is that a lot of people think that Africa was colonized by Europeans, the majority. But in that case, it was colonized by the Ottoman Empire, which of course built a system which had nothing to do with the European systems, whether it was the Belgians, the French, or the British.
And so fast forward to today, we've already seen in 2011... the lopping off of a territory becoming the independent nation of South Sudan. Are we about to witness another partition?
Could be, and that probably would be a way to some kind of peace. Because the Southern Sudan was always something which was a marginal. First of all, it was not Muslim. Second, it had very little Arabic influence.
That's done and dusted. But now, are you suggesting that there could be a partition with Darfur?
Of course. Now, the problem is, will the partition with Darfur stop the war? Because there could be a partition, it wouldn't stop the war.
Well, I think the idea of partition is part of this the other camp that was waging war against the Sudanese population and state. Was a part of their P plan.
You're saying that's what Hemeti wants?
Yeah, that's what Hemeti wants, what their regional and international sponsors want, because they, first, when their A plan failed, they came to P plan. And this, what we have witnessed, aggression, this against Al-Fashir, is indication of, because they think the only area that left was free under the influence of the SAF or government of Sudan and the joint forces is Al-Fashir and North Darfur, capital of North Darfur, which is the largest region in Darfur. So These are the indicator of they are going for that plan, but the fierce resistance that was faced by the Darfuris, this indication of no, this B plan is not going to work out, no matter how long will
this... So you're saying, just to be clear, that Darfuris believe in the nation of Sudan?
Yes, we believe in the unifying nation of Sudan. We believe that even though the Darfur was attached to Sudan after 1917 by the British as as a punishment for the Sultanate that who sided on the losing camp in the First World War, but Darfur always remain and want to be remain part of the unified Sudan, because the separation is not the solution for us Darfuris.
Dalia Abdelmanem, is there a risk of partition with the current civil war?
I have to agree with Jaffer. I think it's a plan that outside actors would like for it to come to fruition. But, you know, there's high resistance towards Hemeti, and he is from Darfur. So when the people of Darfur are even fighting against him, that says a lot about, you know, how they feel. And I personally do not subscribe to that. I think it's an ulterior design by certain elements, whether they're from Sudan or outside of Sudan.
Who are those outside elements?
Outside actors, you know, countries that have a vested interest in creating new territories within Africa for the resources. Sudan is a very rich country in resources, whether it's water, minerals, gold. The smuggling of gold has not stopped ever since day one of the war. It's the war economy is booming for certain actors. And at the same time, you know, they would love to have the port, the Red Sea. So, desirable factors about Sudan that would make certain actors, especially within the region and within the outside, extended region of this part of the world, that they could have a partition, or they would have more of a say in how the government or any future government of Sudan would be, so that their interests are not, their interests remain high, and that they have, I reaffirm that we as Sudanese, we do not subscribe to that partition of Darfur. Darfur is part of Sudan, as is the rest of the country.
Gérard Prunier, is it down to outside players just to a certain degree?
I think the lady is very diplomatic. The answer of the question you fielded is very clear. It's the United Arab Emirates. And they are the ones who are backing Hemeti. They are delivering weapons which are mostly supplied by the Russians. And the weapons are taken to Dubai, and then they are flown to Chad, or at times they are sent by ship when it's heavy equipment to Benghazi, where it is I forget his name, the guy who is Khalifa Haftar, who takes delivery and then takes them by truck across the desert.
Because there's been this week, the news has been dominated by a curious case of a Russian-made military transport plane shot down in North Darfur, each side claiming the plane was supplying the other side. The RSF says the plane took off after a delivery, an airdrop to a delivery to the army in the besieged city of Al-Fasher. But until recently, it was documented that this plane was supplying the rebels with flights via Chad. Among the documents found on the deceased, the expired passport of 67-year-old Viktor Granov, it's not confirmed that it's him, but there's suspicion it may be. A 2005 report by Amnesty International identifies Granov as a South Africa-based businessman formerly associated with Russian arms trader Viktor Bout, who was recently swapped for...
recently.
Yeah. And who's back in business, by the way.
It's a wonderful situation. I mean, the crazy world we live
dealers,
in.
Yeah, but hold on. Arms dealers, they deliver, it's plausible they could deliver to both sides?
The Russians are delivering weapons to both sides.
Yeah.
both sides.
Yes, sir.
And actually, the drones that were delivered by the Iranians to Burhan are countermanded by the artillery that is delivered to Hemeti through Khalifa Haftar and by the way of Benghazi. And these guys go through Chad. You know, the Russians don't give a damn. The only thing that matters is gold. And they are getting a lot of it from both sides. And you know, it was interesting that Hemeti flew to Moscow as soon as Putin attacked the Ukraine. He flew the next day. And he was asking Putin, because that I know from inside sources, he was asking Putin, does that change anything to our arrangements? And Putin said, no problem. Because Putin actually has a lot of the Sudanese gold under his own hands. And they are used to bypass various instances in the Russian government. Because Putin, of course, is the boss in Russia, but that doesn't stop the fact that there are structures and ways of doing things, and that unmarked money is wonderful. And so the result is that Russians are working for both sides. No, and they don't care. They couldn't care less.
But I think...
Jafar Mohammed Sahani.
Concerning this particular incident of the plane, I think Russian, yes, before... The war, Russia were there. They're providing both sides arms and all that. But when this the war intensify and has reached a highest level, I think all this movement, suspected, you know, suspicious movement around Sudan on delivering weapons and all that, the Emiratis are behind this. The Emiratis are the one who are paying, you know, anyone that can be able to deliver weapons in Darfur because. What we have, you know, also we have here several reports that, you know, I mean, there are, you know, the Russian expert and all that in Darfur. But when you trace back, I think you'll see the footprint of Emiratis are all everywhere in Darfur.
All right. Just a word, because the BRICS summits concluded this Thursday. The elephant in the room was Ukraine, with participants backing rival sides at times. But it could have just as well been Sudan, what with Egypt squarely behind General Buran, while Russia is on more on the side of the RSF, says our panel. By the way, the gold that goes to the Gulf, well, you can think about it when you see these images. On the eve of the summit, Putin hosting a dinner for Emirati President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. MBZ, as he's otherwise known. Dalia Abdelmonem, your question for you on, again, what does this story about the plane that was shot down tell you?
Like members of this panel both said, Russia is playing both sides. But seeing these pictures of MBZ with Putin, the United States released a statement, joint statement with the UAE talking about their partnership, and Sudan was given two paragraphs saying that they will endeavor with their humanitarian aid. And like it's been well reported and documented by the likes of the Washington Post, New York Times, and even the United Nations, the UAE is supplying the RSF with weapons. So they want to help us with one hand and kill us with the other, so to speak. So MBZ meeting with Putin, it's just, this is the world, you know, politics at play. You know, you go for what's in your best interest. And unfortunately, what's in their best interest is not in the best interest of Sudan nor of its civilians. And unfortunately, we are the ones who are paying the price. It's neither Hemeti nor Burhan who are paying the price of this war. It's us, you know, civilian Sudanese who've been forced to flee, forced to leave their homes and leave everything behind. And we're basically in no man's land. We can't go anywhere. We can't move. And some of us who couldn't leave Sudan are facing the barrel of the artillery weaponry. They're being killed. And so this video, this meeting, the shutting down of the plane, you know, it will continue. They will continue to supply arms. They will continue to give assistance to both sides, and both sides will continue killing the civilians.
I was just going to put to Gérard Prunier, because, again, the route for these planes to get into Darfur is to go via Chad. That's according to what's called the Sudan Conflict Observatory out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What's Chad's role in all of this?
Chad is trying to keep in one piece, because since Debbie's father died in mysterious circumstances,
officially in battle.
Yeah, officially in battle. I'm not sure at all he died in battle. You should know that more, because
I don't know.
There are enough Zahawa around in the neighborhood to know what actually happened. And, this country is on the verge of disintegrating. And because the Zahawa who control that country represents 3% of the population. And, it could fall apart very easily. So Debbie is trying to survive. So he's giving openings to the Russians one way or the other. And if they want to send something to Hemeti, good. They want to send something to Burhan, good also. Because actually, his problem is not there. He's not Chadian. He's not Darfurian. And so he's trying to survive in a very difficult situation. And the Russians project a shadow over the whole show.
Claire Sanfilippino, I'm not going to draw you on politics. You work for a humanitarian aid organization, but tell us what it was like on the Chadian side, how tense it felt, and how much of a strain it was on the local population there.
Maybe just before, I can't talk about politics or about guns, but I just wanted to talk about what guns do to people. And really, in Sudan, people continue to die due to violence-related injuries day in and day out. And here I want to talk about what our teams are witnessing in Omdurman and in South Khartoum, where we continue to support hospitals. In Omdurman, we have hit the very sad mark of over 10,000 war wounded treated since August 2023. So that's an extremely high number. And in South Khartoum Hospital, we support Al-Mashayikh Hospital. Since the beginning of the year only, we've treated over 3,000 trauma cases. And just 2 days ago, we received 39 patients coming to the hospital after an airstrike that hit less than a kilometer away from the hospital. And some children were already dead on arrival, and 11 more were severely burnt. We're seeing, since the beginning of the offensive, increased number of violent cases, gunshot wounds, and bomb blasts. So it's important, to bear that in mind, that on a daily basis, people continue to be hurt because of violence. And that's very much because of that violence that people flee to Chad, where they hope to seek, safety. So at the border, the women I talked to were really in a very, very difficult situation. And it was very clear that, they didn't leave their country because they wanted to. They left their country because they had no other choice, particularly because of the excruciating violence that has been going on for months now in El-Fasher. And one of, our local doctor was telling me, and was very moved, that one of his patients who had diabetes couldn't stop crying. It was an elderly Sudanese woman, and she'd never left her village in Darfur near Al-Fasher. She never wanted to leave, and she had to leave because her entire family left. So very difficult stories there, and people really who suffered violence in Sudan, but then also came to for safety. And unfortunately, a lot of them were malnourished.
How much of a strain is it on what did you witness in terms of the strain on the Chadian side of all these arrivals, all these refugees?
Well, I can't really necessarily talk to that, but what I can tell you is that the health services, we have a mobile clinic, and the services that we offer are both for people who come from Sudan and also for the Chadian community who lives there. So the situation in Chad is obviously challenging as far as the humanitarian situation is concerned. So we're very much aware of that. And that's why ETINA, the health services, that the mobile clinic that we offer, is open to both. The majority of the people who come are Sudanese, but we also treat some Chadian, and we've just started a vaccination campaign that is both for refugees and also the host community.
All right, so Claire pointing out that guns getting in easier than humanitarian aid, it seems. And while MBZ was in Russia, over in Riyadh, MBS hosting the U.S. Secretary of State, Mohammed bin Salman, who, along with Washington, have been trying to co-sponsor some kind of a mediation to get peace talks off the ground. It was kind of interesting in that respect to see those images. And Sudan did get a mention in the statements from there, a passing mention at least. Is it more than a passing mention, Dalia Abdel-Moneim? Are there serious efforts being undertaken?
I don't think so. I think they're trying, or they pretend to be trying, but not much effort, because if they wanted to, you know, levers can be pulled and they can apply more pressure on both sides to somehow end the war, but they're not. So what we're trying to do right now in the civic society side is to push for more attention to be given to the protection of civilians. Because if we can't get a ceasefire, then at least, we can try and work and get protection for the civilians, because, you know, they're the ones who are bearing the brutal brunt of this war. So, and the protection of civilians should not be contingent on there being a ceasefire reached, because it's obvious neither Burhan nor Hemeti have any interest in ending this war without one of them emerging victorious. And by the looks of it, you know, neither side is going to give up or give in anytime soon. So the next thing that needs to be the top of the agenda is the protection of civilians. And I think this
is
where...
How do you do that?
You can create safe zones, create safe zones. You can send in a hybrid protection unit made up of African Union troops, for example, like they did for Darfur back in 2007, I think, after the Darfur war. You can do the same thing this time, because it's not just one area of Sudan that's being, you know, pummeled by, you know, war. It's the whole country that's being pummeled by war, and civilians need protection. So you can create safe zones. You can, for example, declare that areas like schools, churches, mosques, these are safe areas, playgrounds, you know, don't attack, no indiscriminate bombings, protect them. Don't make it contingent on there being a ceasefire, and then you go in and try and protect the civilians, because by then there might not be any civilians left. We're a population of 44 million, and more than half of us have either, more than 10 million of us have already been displaced, and more than half of us are facing famine. So where's the protection for that? You know, if the idea that people are dying from lack of food in this day and age is not shocking, I don't know what else can shock people into taking action, into actually having a sense of urgency about what's happening in Sudan.
Jafar Mohammed Sainin, it's due to come up, by the way, next week at the United Nations in New York, but they're already pouring cold water on the idea of any kind of peacekeeping force. So the idea of some kind of hybrid force to protect civilians, that's a dream deferred at this point, it seems.
Well, let me firstly disagree with you, with Dalia, because this is, you know, one of the reasons what is prolonging this war is this false narrative of two sides. There is only one side that is creating all these suffering, tragedies, and all this problem. Today, for example, who is fleeing from Darfur? The citizens. Who's attacking them? Who is burning villages in north of Darfur, where there are no president of the SAF? Who is burning villages and killing civilians, pushing them toward Chad in west of Darfur, not the SAF? Who is today taking revenge, campaign of revenge in places like on 45 villages in east of Al Jazeera? We're hearing
Al Jazeera State.
Yeah, shocking report of killing, rape.
What's the job?
Please, let me finish my point. Let me finish my point. You see, who's killing them? So, if we want to stop this war, the solution of this, you know, the international peacekeeping forces and these ideas are propagated by the political wing what they call the taqaddum, the political parties. That's who became, for the Sudanese, became the political incubator of this militia who is committing the heinous crime in history. So to stop this war, you have to address, there is an aggressor and there is a defender. Who's attacking Al-Fashir? This is the question people need to answer. And instead of going around and trying to just create this false narrative and propagate their political agenda on our expense, our people are dying. Who is shelling the hospitals?
So you're saying one side is to blame. Dalia Abdelmonem.
Yeah, can I just...
It's only one side to blame. This is...
I am not taqaddum. I have never been taqaddum.
I'm not accusing you to be a taqaddum, but your language.
One at a time. Your language. Dalia Abdelmonem.
So what you are saying is indicative of taqaddum.
The people of Fashir, the people of Al Jazeera, the people of Kordofan, they're all being killed, and they're being killed by both sides. We need to protect them. I am not saying the RSF is an angel, and I am not saying SAF is an angel. But what I am saying is that the civilians are the ones who are paying the price because they are the ones who are being killed.
The latest report coming from local sources in Al Jazeera state. You are talking about 45 villages have been run over by rebel support forces, killing, mutilating.
Right, that's this week's news cycle. We have seen those indiscriminate airstrikes on the capital, and that's been done by government forces.
We don't want to justify what is taking place from the other side, but there is an aggressor and there is a defender. This is how things should be.
Gérard Prunier, this change of allegiance of that RSF general in Al Jazeera state, what does that tell you?
What that tells me that, there are three wars going on at the same time. It's a territorial war, it's an ethnic war, and it's a social war. The social aspect was you could expect that some poor Arabs would side with the RSF. So this was a kind of example, although I was told that the guy in question was a common criminal, but that's all right. Common criminals are part of civil wars. This is normal everywhere. And, he was a guy who joined the enemy, because he was an Arab, he was a Shukriya, and he should not have been on that side. He should have been on the government side with what we call Walad al-Balid, the sons of the country. These are the people from the Nile Valley. This should have been his side. But he came from an Arab tribe that was considered to be a carpet. To be used by other Arabs for whatever they wanted, like agricultural work in the farms and so on. So he joined the rebels, fine. And then he probably realized, oh no, there is more money to be made on the other side. So he went back to what he was. He was a major general in the government's army. He joined the rebels. Now he joined back the government. This is civil war.
Right. I think so. It shows the complexity. We're out of time. Dalia Abdelmonem, just a quick question, because we're really out of time. Have you any news of your home in Khartoum?
No, nothing. I have no idea what's happened to our house or what's happened to our neighborhood.
No news from any neighbors? You haven't been able to contact anyone?
Nothing. Mm. Our area is still under control by the RSF.
Well, we wish you the best, and we thank you so much for joining us here from Cairo. I want to thank Jafar Mohamed Sanin, Claire Saint-Philippot from Brussels, Gérard Prunier. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.